Seeking the Self is a podcast that explores the nature of self through personal narratives and psychological commentary. We're co-hosted by best-selling author Natalina High and me, Dr. Aaron Balick, director of Stillpoint Spaces International, an organization that seeks to explore psychology in depth, inside and outside the consulting room. Seeking the Self is proud to build on our relationship with Stillpoint Spaces to now find our new home within Stillpoint Magazine. Join us in each edition where Seeking the Self will offer an audio experience crafted by internationally award-winning producer Hannah Walker Brown that explores that issue's theme, a complement to the magazine's rich imagery and text contributions. You'll find yourself in the eye of the storm, where psychology and culture meet.
I remember I was sitting on the floor, and I must have reached a point of profound stillness or something. And it was as if I remember thinking, oh, this feels like I'm dipping my big toe in the sea of consciousness. And it's like time stopped and everything became crystal clear. And it was as if this little idea was floating around in the ether, and then it kind of just settled in front of me and popped, and it just said in a very, very clear kind of tone, you have to stop. You have to stop what you're doing, and you have to restart, and you have to find out for yourself who you are. And then I just knew.
Welcome to Seeking the Self podcast,
where we explore how we find and lose ourselves in the modern world.
We didn't take medicine. We didn't go to doctors.
It's simple. I try to make sure when I go to bed at night, I lie my head on the pillow and I think today's been a good day.
Because if it was an easy journey, then what are we learning?
I'm Dr. Aaron Balick.
And I'm Natalina High.
And this is Seeking the Self.
In this episode, we meet Paul.
I was dead set on what it would be like to take LSD when you're in a Buddhist retreat center. So I took a tab of acid and I had this experience. So my name is Paul Christelis and I am a psychotherapist. I guess it's one of the things I call myself. I'm not exactly sure what to call myself these days, to be honest. So the other thing that I do is mindfulness teaching. So I guess it's an integration, what I do, of mindfulness, meditation, psychotherapy, a very organic kind of process. So I guess with psychotherapy, that was the most conscious process because I went from school to university and studied psychotherapy, clinical psychology. But I did that because it was kind of expected of me and I had to do something. And when I was in my late 20s, I had an experience actually while I was meditating where I guess for the first time I really started to question what I was doing and why I was doing it. And I couldn't find an answer. So I kind of gave that up. I gave up my practice and basically I gave up the life that I had in South Africa, whereas that's where I'm from. And I came to live in London and actually didn't know who I was or what I wanted to do. It was very uncharacteristic because I'd always kind of followed the straight and narrow. I'd done what was expected of me. And with this, it was a very clear, not a head knowing, it was a embodied knowing. I still don't really know where it came from, but it was very clear that I had to follow it. I sold everything that I had. There were a number of interesting things that happened in my personal life as well to allow that shift to happen. And about 5 months later, I was in London with not a clue about what to do. So I came to London and I came with, this is another strand to the story. I'd just finished an 8-year relationship just before this happened. And then this thing happened and I decided to come and I'd booked my tickets and I met someone at a party 5 weeks before I was due to leave. And when I saw him, I just knew that we were going to be together. And it didn't make sense to me because I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of going out on my own. I'm leaving the country. How's this going to work? And to cut a very long story short, it did work. And he came with me and we're still together. So we've been together for 21 years now. So anyway, he came with me. And for maybe a year or so, I had enough money to survive without working. So we did lots of kind of walking around London, tripping on LSD and, you know, this kind of thing. Stuff that I probably, you know, should have done when I was a lot younger. So I was 29 at the time. And I did a shamanic internship with a shaman, which lasted a few months. And yeah, just kind of odd things like that. Lots of reading and writing. And then when the money ran out, I just felt that, you know, psychotherapy wasn't for me again. I wasn't sure what kind of therapist I would be. I didn't know if I had anything to offer anyone. So I went and worked in restaurants. I worked in an antique shop, knowing absolutely nothing about antiques, and did odd things like that for maybe about 5 years. But during that time, there was a lot of, although it was on some level, it felt quite painful, kind of not knowing my place in the world. And I mean, I have quite a few clients now who I can really resonate when they come to me and, you know, there's a sense of, I don't know who I am, I'm not comfortable in my own skin. And, you know, it can be profoundly, well, my experience was, it was profoundly, there was a kind of internal friction. It's like, I have to exist in the world and do something, and yet I haven't got a clue what that is. So for many years, there was that experience. And there was living with that and just trying to accept that I didn't know. And then very slowly, after about 5 years, I started to do some youth work in Fulham. And then I got a job teaching psychology, A-level psychology in Tower Hamlets. And then I noticed that students would come and talk to me after the class and they'd want advice on things. And I naturally started to fall back into that groove of, you know, doing counseling again. And then gradually from there, started to get back into the world of therapy. But this time from the position of having found myself, I guess, rather than just doing it because it was, you know, something that was expected of me. So I became a lot more of an embodied therapist. And then plus there was my mindfulness. I did a mindfulness training. And yeah, so the two worlds of mindfulness and therapy have kind of dovetailed for me. About 5 years ago, my partner and I went to Peru and we went on an ayahuasca retreat. And I knew very little about it. It was just something that it was in my awareness. But again, something kind of pushed itself to the forefront. And it just felt like the right time for us to go. I wasn't quite sure why I was going. It just felt as if something needed to move internally. So we went to Peru, and that's where I had my first ayahuasca experience, which was, I think, 5 ceremonies of ayahuasca. But the first one was, it was like a baptism by fire. It was really traumatic. It was incredibly potent, and I had no idea what had happened to me, but it really felt like I'd been flung into hell. And I spent a lot of time afterwards trying to integrate and understand that experience. And I think that is the main thing. That's my understanding with ayahuasca, and I see quite a few clients who've had experiences as well. It's not so much about the actual ceremony, it's how you process and integrate that into your conscious awareness afterwards that is really important. So I had this really what felt like a profound experience. Wasn't quite sure what it was. I didn't have any, a lot of people have very clear visions and clear messages. Not everyone, and I wasn't one of those people. I just had a really full-on kind of, it felt like being attacked psychically by dark energy. It was very abstract. Subsequently to that, a lot of the work that I did kind of brought me to an awareness of something that may have happened when I was very young, possibly through the process of being born. I had a sensation of almost kind of being stuck in a very dark place, not being able to get out. And it was suggested to me by my supervisor, who supervises my therapy work, that it may have been something to do with a natal experience. So that kind of opened things up for me, and I started to explore that and to write about that. And subsequent to that, I've done some training in, natal psychology, looking at the birth experience, looking at what happens during conception, implantation, because the body remembers on a cellular level, the body remembers these experiences of birth. And if there's any trauma or whatever it is that we've been through, the body holds that awareness. It's not always conscious. But you can access it through, mindful, open states. And so I've been doing some work around that and just getting a sense of what might have happened and also what happened to me when I was very young. And I had a quite a serious illness when I was about 2.5, 3 years old. And I was separated from my mother in those days, in the 60s and 70s. I don't think medicine was as enlightened about attachment and, the importance of, the parents being around when children are ill in hospital. And I was told that I used to bash my head against the cot in the hospital, protesting when my mother left. So they forbade my mother to come again and see me. So I think part of the experience I experienced in ayahuasca was this trauma of feeling completely abandoned. Because when you're that age, when you're a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old and, your mother's not there anymore, it's like, the whole world has just ended. And that's what the experience was like for me. So I think my body still held that memory on a cellular level. And in order for me to process that, which I don't think I've ever really done because it's out of awareness, the ayahuasca brought that to consciousness. And so that then gave me the opportunity to consciously work through that, which is part of what I've been doing over these past few years.
I'm curious a little bit about integrating experience that is so far from normal everyday experience. If it's people who have taken psychedelics, acid or DMT or ayahuasca may have an aha moment, a peak experience in which they feel really in touch with something, which might be wonderful or might scare them, but gives them a new piece of information. Mm-hmm. And then as they come towards sobriety again, as the trip moves away, it can be hard to integrate that experience actually into life because it comes from such a different visceral experience. And I wonder, that certainly happens, but it sounds like with you, something enabled you to integrate as well. So I wonder if you could say something about that.
I think that's true. Unless you can integrate, I think that experience just remains a disembodied experience. And in fact, I think it can be quite dangerous because I think people, because they can't integrate that, feel they need to continue using substances, which obviously has its own problems. I know it's interesting. I'm not really sure that, if you have an aha moment, I'm not really sure that it's even advisable to try to get someone to re-experience that in a conscious state. I don't really know that that's really where the work is. You know, I think sometimes, as I was explaining a little bit earlier, when I had this like profound meditative experience, and the meditation teacher told me I should just try and forget it. It really wasn't important. And I was devastated because I thought this was my gateway to enlightenment. And he saw it as being a distraction. You know, for him, the meditation isn't about the aha experience. It's about the profound ordinariness of just sitting with your own experience and going deeper into that, which isn't very kind of rock and roll. You know, it's not glitzy. It's not the kind of stuff that we all think we're after. So, yeah, those aha experiences, I think, can open a door. And they can maybe give people a little bit of they can be catalysts for something. But I don't necessarily think you have to go back to that experience to try and understand it. I think what's important is it was a catalyst for something. And then when you're working with someone, you're working with what they bring. You're not trying to go back to that experience and try to recreate it or try to understand it. You're working with who are they now and why have they come back now? And then 2 years later, we went back and I had a longer experience. When I went back the second time, I was incredibly fearful that the same thing would happen. It was like just beyond comprehension that I would have to go through that again. But I knew that I had to. It felt like unfinished business. So when I went, I was very, very sheepish and very cautious. And the experience was very different, but there was a sense of every time I took it, I felt like I was this invalid in hospital and that I couldn't move and that I was just waiting in a hospital bed to recover and that I was just having to sit with this terrible pain, feeling still quite abandoned. And I think what I probably got in touch with that second time was the period of recuperation after the illness. It was more about recuperating from illness and staying with the healing and the difficulty rather than distracting myself from it. So that whole period in the jungle was really about just, you know, being aware of how damaged the body was and allowing myself to be consciously awake to that experience. What happens in an ayahuasca ceremony is that, you know, typically it would be at night. Ceremony can happen anywhere in the world, but my experience was to go into the Amazon, and what you do there is there's usually a kind of a hut that you go into. It's usually circular. There's usually a group of people. Everyone has a spot in the kind of circular tent with a mattress and a bucket for obvious reasons. Maybe it's not so obvious because there's a lot of purging in an ayahuasca ceremony, usually. So through vomiting or diarrhea or crying or screaming, you know, it's the body letting go of, you know, energy, toxic energy and trauma. So you all take your place in the circle, and then the shaman will come, or the shamans. There's usually more than one. The times that I've been, there've been Westerners, but there've also been some indigenous ayahuasca shamans, who basically, many of them, since they've been small children, have been called to be healers. So they've been taking ayahuasca for, you know, years and years. And when it's your turn, you go up to the center and you drink the ayahuasca, which is a kind of it's sometimes called a tea. And it looks like a sludgy, brown, kind of oily kind of liquid. It is the most atrocious tasting, vile tasting concoction that I've ever tasted. And it's well known for being really pretty disgusting. the only way that I can really describe it is it's a kind of like, it tastes a bit like blood. Blood and licorice. But it just tastes wrong on so many levels. And just to keep it down is difficult enough. You just, well, my experience was I've just wanted to vomit it right out. But you've got to keep it in your system. So you do that for about half an hour, and then it's pitch black, and the shaman starts singing what's called an Ikaros, which is a song or songs which they say have been taught to them by the plant itself. And the songs are there to encourage the ayahuasca to work on the body and to start the healing. And everyone has very different experiences around the actual ceremony. A lot of people have hallucinations, they see things quite clearly. Some people have, you know, really euphoric experiences. Some people have very traumatic experiences. It's very different for everyone, but this is the psychoactive element of the plant that's working. And in the very first ceremony that I had it was quite bizarre, but it was very clear what was happening. I could see ayahuasca, the spirit of ayahuasca, almost as a huge, this will sound quite bizarre, but a huge green insect made of like green neon light. It almost looked like a grasshopper. And as I was lying down, I could see and feel this creature open me up. So it was like a surgeon, and I've heard other people describe this as well. Opened me up as if I was on an operating table and start to rummage around inside of me. And I could see my body was like code. And as it was rummaging inside, all the code started to get scrambled up and placed in a different position. And I could feel that I was being readied for something. It's like my cellular body was being worked on and reconfigurated. I didn't know why. But I felt like I was being made ready for an operation. And that was the only thing that happened in that ceremony. And then when I went back the second night, that's when I had this really, really traumatic experience. And then the third, fourth, and fifth was a little gentler, but there was an element of starting to integrate what had happened. So a ceremony can last really, you know, anything from about, I'd say, 3 to maybe 5 or 6 hours. Although time just doesn't make much sense when you're in that kind of space. You know, it feels like it lasts eons. You know, you can go through what feels like, you know, almost a lifetime. And then pretty much the next day, there's absolutely no sense of being hungover. You're absolutely fine. So it's not like taking a drug where you're feeling a little kind of wobbly. And for some people, they need one ceremony. Other people I know have gone back and have gone hundreds of times. It all really depends, I guess, on what you're looking for and what needs to be healed. It's a bizarre, beautiful, mysterious kind of process, but you definitely get the sense that there is this intelligence, this plant intelligence that is working on you. And it's incredibly humbling. And, you know, once you've experienced it, you know it to be true. If you haven't experienced it, it's just words, you know? So even though intellectually you might be open to that possibility, if it's not embodied, then there's always, I guess, room for doubt. It's like, well, you know, can that really happen? Is that what really happens? But it does feel like something has shifted. I'm not exactly sure where, and I know that I have to go back because I know that my work is not finished. And there is still a little bit of fear there, and that's what tells me that my work isn't finished. So my sense is that when I do go back, which will, you know, probably be sometime later this year, that there will be more clarity around that. But I'd say that, you know, what I am aware of is that I've got over the initial trauma, And a lot of the work that I'm doing personally on myself, and I guess also as a therapist, is about integrating all that knowledge and becoming stronger in myself as I integrate it. But it's certainly not done.
You know, this is a podcast called Seeking the Self. When some people have these experiences, whether they're on ayahuasca or whether it's through meditation or whether it's through psychotherapy or some other psychosis even, they feel that they're coming closer to a self. Other people have experiences of no self, that seeking the self, they discover or find no self, mm-hmm. or maybe both, mm-hmm. or maybe it's not the whole non-dual mm-hmm. thing. Did it bring you closer to something you would call a self? Did it bring you closer to something like a non-self? Or do these kind of binary categories, do they not work very well when you're talking about this kind of experience?
It's, you know, just speaking from my own experience, I'd say it encompasses both. So with the ayahuasca experience, there was definitely a sense of some kind of self. I'm not even sure it's a psychological self, although I think that was part of it. But there was a sense of me being some kind of energetic entity. There was a sense of it being quite an old entity that may have been passed down through many, you know, incarnations. And then I've had experiences where there's been a feeling of not self or no self. I remember I shouldn't really say this because, I'll say it anyway, but I was about 30 and I'd gone to a Buddhist retreat center in South Africa. And of course, you know, one of the precepts of, you know, meditation and being in that environment is that you don't take drugs or mind-altering substances. But I was like in the throes of, you know, this kind of period of discovery, and I was dead set on what it would be like to take LSD when you're in a Buddhist retreat center. So I took a tab of acid, and I remember sitting down and just under a Buddhist statue in a beautiful environment in the Ikopa Hills in Natal in South Africa, in a place called God's Basin, which was very apt, kind of looking down into a valley. And I had this experience, which I guess, you know, I would say it wasn't a self experience, but it was an experience where, you know, I started to cry, and there was this feeling of sadness, but it wasn't a sadness that had anything to do with me or with being a person. It felt more like kind of tapping into sadness, just this universal sadness, whatever that was. And it was as if my whole body was leaking tears. My whole body was crying. And it was not personal at all. So although I was feeling, you know, tremendous grief and pain, I don't know for what. I don't know if, you know, if it was like some kind of archetypal pain or something. But there was also a sense of complete equanimity about it, and complete calm and openness. And it was profoundly not about me. And so there have been one or two times, I guess maybe you call that a peak experience or something, where there's been a sense of, you know, there is no such thing as a self. And then there have been other times where it's felt like profoundly this is about myself. So I don't know really how you put those two things together, but that's been my experience.
You know, there is a distinction between self and ego, isn't there? And that, in a sense, what also may be a difference between pain and suffering. So to be able to experience sorrow and grief as a self or not self, however that was for you, and to experience that through ego, where it becomes distressing, seem like very different things. I mean, I had an experience similarly on mushrooms. I was coming down, but I was looking out the window of my dorm room in college, and it was just dawn, and I was thinking about all of the people out there, like who were going to be waking up, and like some people would be waking up and someone will be dying in their life, or somebody else is breaking up in a relationship, or someone else is just starting a relationship. And I went on this like ride of experiencing all the different emotions that any of those imagined people could have. And it was very similar. Like they weren't, I wasn't experiencing it as an ego in that moment. I was kind of experiencing it as I imagined other people's egos. But you used the word equanimity before, that one can have an experience of an emotion that most of us would agree is unpleasant. Sorrow, grief, sadness. But somehow if that is experienced outside of an egoic thing, mm-hmm. it seems like it didn't feel painful. Like somehow you were completely open to that experience.
It's like, it reminds me of, you know, that Buddhist teaching, you know, something that we teach in mindfulness courses, that, you know, as you say, there's a difference between suffering and pain. And, you know, the kind of adage goes that pain is inevitable, suffering is not. And so we're all going to experience pain, you know, whether that's like physical pain or, you know, the pain of impermanence or emotional pain. The suffering is, that's what the Buddhists call the second arrow or the second dart. The first dart is the pain. We're all going to be hit by the first dart. The second dart is all of the egoic stuff that we add to the first dart. So it's the why, woe is me, why is me, why did this happen to me? Oh, this is terrible. Oh, this doesn't fit. It shouldn't have been exactly, you know, this doesn't fit with, you know, and it's unfair, all that kind of stuff. So when the ego gets involved with pain, that's where suffering comes. So you can have people who, you know, may be racked with pain. You know, people who maybe go through, you know, lots of really, really difficult life experiences, or they have, you know, chronic pain, who live with equanimity. Because even though the pain is there, it's bearable because their relationship to it is more from this place of, as we were talking about earlier, from a place of presence rather than from a place of ego. When the ego gets involved, there's this kind of contraction around it. And then you identify yourself with the pain. You know, I am the pain. And that's when there's true suffering. So pain will always be, and I think that's just a, you know, that's a given. But how you choose to be with it is not a given. That is something that, you know, I think we actually do have control over. Now, that's making it sound maybe a little easy, but obviously to actually cultivate that is, and to cultivate that kind of equanimity is, you know, it's that's real work, and that doesn't come easily. And I know a lot of people who come along for therapy or, you know, want to learn mindfulness or whatever it is, are hoping that, you know, they will get that quick and easy way of handling pain. And I think it's really, it's a lifelong choice to choose to have a relationship with yourself where you are coming more from a place of presence rather than from that place of ego. And I do think that takes work. Again, I was thinking about this as I was walking here today, because I knew that, you know, our talk would be something about the self. I wasn't exactly sure where it would go, and I was asking myself, you know, well, you know, what am I going to say if that comes up? And, you know, you can find the kind of textbook answers, and I mean, I have some ideas around, you know, what the self is, and is it just part of your identity that's built up through years of conditioning? You know, is it based on accumulated memories? Is it something that you come into the world with already? You know, have there been past selves that you've accumulated over the course of other lifetimes? I don't know. I don't know. And I just had a strange image. I had an image of being on my deathbed. I mean, I know that this is a bit crazy. Of course, this would never happen. But I had an image of being on my deathbed, hopefully when I'm a lot older, and having this interview played back, which is really crazy. And listening to this and thinking, God, no, that's not it at all. That's not what the self is. No, that's not it. I think most of us have some kind of compulsion to you know, clarify that, you know, we have this compulsion to have an identity and to call ourselves something. I guess that's, you know, to survive in the modern world, you know, it's, you know, especially in the West, it's kind of a prerequisite. You need to have something that you can call yourself, and some semblance of an identity. But I don't know. I mean, I think for me, there's a difference between what I'd call the self or the person and presence. And this is part of some spiritual teaching that I guess resonates with me, is that we spend most of our time in the identifying ourselves as a person. And the person is the personality, it's the ego, it's all the conscious stuff that we're aware of in terms of who we are. But if you step out of that, there's an awareness, you can notice that there is an awareness of the person. So if you step into the position of being the awareness, so I'm aware that I'm this person, I'm aware that I'm wanting to have this identity, I'm aware that I have this personality. If you are the awareness, then you aren't the person. You're something beyond the person. And if you can come from a place of, you know, identifying more with the awareness, then you live your life more in a state of presence, just being present. You can identify, oh, there I am, being this little person. Oh, how funny am I, being this little person with these little concerns and trying to make his way in the world and trying to be important. But I don't take that person all that seriously, because from this position of awareness, it's just so much more spacious. There's, when I'm not identified with the person, there's a gap between that person and me as presence. And my sense is that living in that space of presence is a much more open, a much more... there's a freedom, because when you're a person, or when you're the self, you're imprisoned by the particular ideas of who that self should be. I'm not sure if that makes much sense.
Yeah, it does.
And there are times when, you know, I guess when you're in a meditative space, or maybe when you're not taking yourself seriously, where, in my experience, you have a moment of touching that sense of what it means just to be presence and not to have a name, not to have an occupation. It doesn't mean you don't get things done. It doesn't mean you don't work in the world. It doesn't mean that you don't have this personality, but you're not identified with that personality. It's not that's who I am. It's just part of this thing that you are, but it's not you. There's a greater, what's the word? Space that you can be in when you're not identifying with that person.
I'm Dr. Aaron Balick.
And I'm Natalie Nahai.
And this is Seeking the Self.